1794. April, May, June. 3 months in which the French and British fight their first major fleet action of these wars.
The idea was that he would provoke a melee and create confusion and chaos, bringing the French into close action.
As France is gripped by the Great Terror, the man at its center is going through a personal crisis.
He was losing his grip somewhat, yes. I think, I mean, they don't have a word for it in the late 18th century, but I think we would call it something like burnout.
And on the front line, the French scrape major victories at Tourcoing and Fleurus, thanks in part to the Austrians letting down the British.
The British are there. We know where the other Austrian columns are. They can't support him. We're going to attack them there.
I'm Alexander Stevenson, and this is episode 10 of the Napoleonic Quarterly, covering 3 months in which infighting and the French foil the Allied plan of destruction. The Napoleonic Quarterly takes the epic conflicts of the 1792 to 1815 period 3 months at a time. And for the 3 months covered by this episode, I'm joined by Rachel Blackman Rogers, Marisa Linton, and Philip Bull. But first, here's the headline developments to bring you up to speed. The glorious 1st of June is certainly the highest profile date in this 3 months, but this is actually the decisive fifth day of a drawn-out engagement in the Atlantic between the French and British battle fleets, which both sides can claim victory for. The British might have come out better from the fight, but the grain convoy of over 120 ships which the British were after manages to reach French ports unscathed. In the Caribbean, the British take Saint Lucia and then Guadeloupe in April, while on Saint-Domingue they occupy Port-au-Prince, the capital, in June. At the same time, though, Toussaint Louverture completes his switch from the Spanish to the French Republican side. In Poland, the army under Kościuszko exceeds expectations by beating a Russian force in early April, and then throws out the Russian garrison from Warsaw later in the month. But a Russian counter-offensive is underway by May, with the Prussians also providing support against the Poles. In Flanders, the French mount an offensive into Belgium, which gets bogged down with a series of setbacks, before a concerted Allied offensive ends up in defeat at Tourcoing on 18th May. After clinging on at Tournai later in May, the French then invest Charleroi in June, before the Austrians are defeated at Fleurus, leaving the Austrians beginning to withdraw from Belgium and the Netherlands by the end of this quarter. In Italy, French forces make progress against the Piedmontese in April, while at the end of the month the French launch a new offensive against the Spanish, eventually taking back all of Spain's original gains against France after the Battle of Boulou. And in French politics, Danton and Desmoulins are executed on April the 5th, giving Robespierre and the Committee of Public Safety space to double down again with a new Law of Prairial on 10th June. That's the end of the headline developments. Sadly, the audio quality is going to go south almost instantaneously for this episode. I hope you find it bearable, because in terms of the words said, this is a cracker of an episode. In the meantime, you can be reassured that I've worked out which button not to press for next time.
So, an awful lot going on in this 3 months. So much to pick over. And thankfully, we have Charles Esten and Alexander Mika-Baridze to sum it all up. So much there. But Alex, perhaps I might ask you, first of all, is there anything that particularly jumps out, you know, in this 3 months? What's the really What do you think is the biggest headline that should lead the news bulletins covering this 3 months?
To me, it is the continued narrative of French military outperforming their allies, because we've seen how crucial war was to radicalizing the French revolutionary rhetoric, bringing about uprisings within the larger revolutionary narrative, which ultimately brought the Jacobins in power. But here, the French military success will have a kind of a reverse impact on the French radicalism, initiating a conversation of the extent of the terror and the continued application of terror in the context of such successful military campaign. And Jacobin inability to address this growing concern of why we need a terror mechanism when we're actually winning the war will ultimately claim the lives of Robespierre and his friends.
And Charles, what would you pick out from this 3 months as being the really big story to talk about here?
I mean, I would second Alex. You have a tremendous irony in that the more Robespierre and company were successful, the more insecure their position became. And you have to remember that even Robespierre and his close colleagues were not actually in principle in favour of terror. They had made the great switch as a response to crisis, and they hadn't been happy about it, but they'd done it because they believed it was the only way to save the revolution. The revolution is now saved, and that means that Robespierre and his friends are going to be in serious trouble, because frankly, everybody has become, if you'll forgive the expression, terrified of them. Nobody knows who's going to fall under the guillotine next. And the more that they succeed, the more vulnerable they become.
Okay, so what about the military front? What's your view of how that's progressing?
Well, here I think there are essentially two big stories, and neither of them are happening in Belgium. Yes, all right, the French eventually end up on top after the Battle of Fleurus, but there are two really big things happening. The one is the war in Poland, which has the capacity to affect everything else going on in Europe. And the other is the almost forgotten story down in the south of France, where the Spaniards and the Portuguese are now the only foreign troops on French soil, and they're expelled from the soil of France after a battle at the beginning of April at a place called Boulou. The Spanish commander-in-chief, General Ricardos, is killed in the battle. His forces are driven back across the Pyrenees, and the sacred soil of France is free of the invader.
Well, we've talked a lot about the goings-on on the soil of France, but perhaps we need to transfer our attention to the waves of the Atlantic, because that's the subject of our first interview today, which is with Rachel Blackman-Rogers. She's a PhD candidate studying at King's College London, and her thesis is on Britain Facing Unlimited War, Strategic Evolution and Cultural Transformation in 1796, 97 and 98. But here she is talking about events a couple of years before that, and this is all about the glorious 1st of June. I asked her what the objectives were for the French and the British forces in this quarter.
The they were both premier fleets for the British and the French, the Brest Fleet and the Channel Fleet, and both of these fleets detached grain intercept squadrons to deal with the convoy. The actual fleets, their mission was to make sure that their opposing fleet didn't interfere with that mission of intercepting the convoy. So they actually had quite separate missions. Villeray-Joyeuse, who was the admiral of the Brest fleet, whilst it was his priority to make sure that the convoy made it in, the message under that was that he had to stop the Channel Fleet interfering with that convoy, because the French had more than compensated for protecting that convoy coming in by sending out a squadron under Rear Admiral Nieri. And they'd also assigned an escort under Rear Admiral Van Stabel, who was an excellent Garde de Corps privateer and fully understood the merchant routes across the Atlantic and was brilliant at what he was about to do. So they made it fairly secure. Villeret-Joyeuse just had to make sure that Earl Howe and the Channel Fleet didn't interfere with that process. And for the British, their intercept squadron under Rear Admiral George Montagu simply had to stop the convoy reaching Brest and deny the French access to that vital grain convoy.
So quite straightforward, if you were setting this up as a board game, you've got the mission of the French fleet is to stop the British from stopping this convoy getting to France. Is that simple?
Yeah, essentially. And Villeret-Joyeuse would have understood that from his orders. And that was certainly clear. He sailed when he spotted Howe's fleet off Brest and made sure that they weren't laying anywhere in the path of the potential convoy, and Howe followed. And because it was his job to stop Villeret-Joyeuse interfering with the squadron. So they both knew what they were doing and they did it. And it was just a bit further out in the Atlantic than they might have hoped.
And why was it further out in the Atlantic?
It was part of the chase. The further Villeret-Joyeuse could take Howe, and it had taken Howe 3 days to realise that the French fleet had sailed. The French fleet had deliberately blocked the Brest opening with a little squadron of frigates, so it was quite difficult for Howe to gain intelligence. He did send in a little squadron of his own to check up, but they tried to make it as difficult as possible, and he didn't learn about their sailing for 3 days, so they got a head start. And then it was only when he intercepted a prize convoy that he found out where they were.
So this was the big moment when he suddenly realised that, hang on a second, they're over there. Come on, everyone follow me. And then his fleet was heading in the right direction. So what was the French counter move to that?
Well, they were sailing looking for Howe's fleet. I mean, the Atlantic is huge. You know, they were looking almost for each other, essentially. And Joyeuse had to make sure that he didn't go too far. And if he met the convoy, that would be a bonus because obviously he'd be reinforced. But it didn't really matter. Just as long as he stopped the British interfering, it would be better if they didn't meet the convoy, in fact. And he knew where the convoy was going to meet Neely. So that was useful. But I mean, the key thing to really recognise about this is how vital this grain convoy was. The French were hoping that it was going to save their regime and keep the Committee of Public Safety going and general security. And the British were hoping the exact opposite, that by denying the French that convoy, they were going to be able to trigger the collapse and implosion of the French regime and end the war. So it was fairly pivotal, this convoy.
So it was extremely high stakes then, but it sounds more like a game of battleships than a really strategic board game, you know, sort of looking for the other fleet in the Atlantic. How did the two fleets end up finding each other?
I think they just, Howe knew roughly where Villeret-Joyeuse was and pursued him and found and saw him on the horizon on the 28th of May. The French spotted the British coming up, and it just took the French a long time to form line, in which time the British could come up and engage. And then they spent 5 days in battle. And the failure of the mission happened near the convoy because neither of the intercept squadrons actually met the convoy at all. Nearly failed to meet the convoy and, in fact, ended up reinforcing Villeret-Joyeuse on the 30th of May, halfway through the glorious 1st of June battles. And Montagu completely failed to find the convoy or really gain substantial intelligence about it. And several times he gathered intelligence that made him believe quite correctly that he was outnumbered. And this made his position increasingly untenable. And he had to return to Britain for reinforcement.
And so the convoy got through.
Well, he was reinforced and he went back out. And this time he got caught between the Brest fleet returning from the 1st of June battle and a fresh squadron arriving from just off from Cancale Bay, just opposite Jersey. And he had managed to chase the smaller squadron into Brest, and the Villeray-Joyeuse was approaching from the other direction. So again, he was overwhelmed, and he had no intelligence at that point, again, of the convoy, which was being expertly guided by Van Stabel along the Atlantic coast. And he actually navigated at the Iroise Passage, which is quite a tricky navigation, into Brest to make sure that he wasn't intercepted.
So this story you're telling is very different from the traditional British narratives, anyway, of the glorious 1st of June, where it's all about, you know, this massive fleet action where these two opposing fleets slug it out against each other. Because as you're saying, that wasn't really the strategic point of any of this. It was all about what was going on through that sneaky little navigational ruse by the convoy there.
Well, that's true, but it is all. But it isn't. I mean, there certainly was a huge fleet action. There was great expectation in Britain that Howe and the Channel Fleet would be able to cause a significant blow and bring to battle the French Brest Fleet, so that the British could secure command of the Channel and maintain that superiority. There was incredible political pressure on him to achieve that as well, so that British naval superiority and her identity as a sea power could be demonstrated not only to Britain but also to Europe and allies. So that was equally important. And the battles, which took place over 5 days, were really significant to that, to achieving that.
Well, how would you describe that battle then? You know, it, very very briefly, but this was a fairly bloody affair.
Well, it was very bloody for the French. That's certainly true. They lost about 5,000 to 7,000 men. Nobody's entirely sure, of course, which is a huge number. The British lost through killed and wounded about 1,000. So it was reasonably bloody. It was a 5-day engagement. There were two partial actions on the 28th and 29th of May. And then there was a lot of fog and the British were trying to gain the weather gauge over the 30th and the 31st. The French were reinforced. The British were repairing their ships. And then the 1st of June action took place, which both sides had certainly been continuing to prepare for. Neither side decided to leave the scene of action.
Was there anything on the tactical side that's of interest? The general sense is that you have a classic line of battle situation in which, and this is really the model that Nelson would shake up in later battles, particularly Trafalgar. But right now, this was just two lines of battle going at each other.
No, not really. One of Howe's strengths was that he was really interested in tactical and technological innovation and was constantly seeking throughout his career to try to create more decisive action and improve conditions and improve a ship's efficiency. So that was in his nature. And he spent his first 18 months in command of the Channel Fleet essentially looking at an integrated signal and tactical system that would enable him to produce a more decisive action. And he managed that. He built on the work of Rodney and Kempenfelt from the American War of Independence. And the idea was that he would provoke a melee and create confusion and chaos, bringing the French into close action. That was what he was really aiming for. And in fact, the glorious 1st of June delivered a victory that hadn't been seen in 100 years.
So it was a big deal after all, yes. And the French were defeated there, but the convoy got through nonetheless. So is it a case of the French having more than a consolation for their defeat?
Not really. The right. regime still collapsed very right. shortly afterwards, so it didn't save the regime. It certainly provided a temporary bridge. It fed the Brest Fed Brest and the Brest fleet and the navy and the surrounding area, and allowed for some repression of northern France and Brittany, where Britain had been sending in food supplies and interfering and supporting the royalist uprising. So it certainly enabled the Republican regime to disrupt that and bring people more over to, well, they were less likely to rebel because they weren't so hungry. And it certainly did that. And it was a bridge. It was a blow to the British that the regime collapsed and France still continued to fight. It wasn't the war they believed it to be. They believed it to be a limited economic war, and therefore the collapse of the regime should have been enough to bring it to an end. But in fact, it was a total unlimited war, and it wasn't enough.
Rachel Blackman there, and her last point's a very interesting one, that actually this grain convoy may have made a small difference, but it wasn't decisive. I got one or two things wrong in that interview, but I think it's a case of some of my preconceptions coming to the fore, that actually this wasn't the starting point of the humdrum line of battle, that Howe was actually an innovator here. And I think that says something about the state of the Royal Navy. So, Charles, what would you say about the state of the Royal Navy, which I suppose we're introducing to the podcast at this stage?
Quite simply, the Royal Navy was the best navy in the world at this point. It was an extremely professional force. It was well equipped. Its ships were first class at every level, not just you know, the line of battle ships like HMS Victory, but you know, small ships as well, like frigates and so forth. It was a very well organized navy. Highly professional officer corps, highly professional petty officer corps, in other words, the equivalent of NCOs in the army. People like bosuns and so forth. Very, very, very high morale. Sailors saw themselves as an elite. They generally expected to win, and usually did win. And also, this was a navy which had a record of fighting, yes, decisive actions. I mean, there is this idea that somehow Nelson invented a new tactic at Trafalgar when he goes hell for leather at the French line and splits it in two. But that's what British admirals have been doing for most of the 18th century. The general idea was you broke up the enemy and moved to close action. And you'd seen that as early as the Battle of Quiberon Bay in 1759. So frankly, Britain is in a very, very strong position. And as I think our good friend Alex is about to tell us, is in a position which is about to get stronger because of the French Revolution.
Absolutely. If Charles has branded the Royal Navy the best navy in the world, I'll go with the French being the second best. How about that?
I can live with that.
In 1789, the French Navy was in many respects beginning a long period of decline. It was something unusual in that sense that if we look at the 18th century, the French Navy did enjoy a number of successes over the Royal Navy, particularly in the Indian Ocean, above all in the Chesapeake Bay, and certainly making possible the British defeat at Yorktown. But all these operations were expensive for France, costing billions of livres, and as we know, the inability to repay this debt contributed to the outbreak of revolution, which in turn has a major, major impact on the Navy. The revolution affected the French naval force in a variety of ways, first at the dockyards and then among the crews and the officers. At the dockyards, workers who were badly paid revolted. For example, at Toulon in December of 89, in Brest in June of 1790. The seamen, who were also quite in a tough spot, you know, all upset about the conditions of pay, not to mention that they were exposed to revolutionary ideology, also rose up in Brest in their own rebellion. And in the face of these disorders, we know that many French naval officers either returned to their homes or simply immigrated, so that by 1792, the vast majority of the French naval officers are actually gone. And so to solve the manpower shortage and to open the naval service to new blood, the National Assembly offered posts of officers in the French Navy to the Merchant Marine. The continued revolutionary turmoil in France meant that French Navy simply has no time to recover. There is not enough money to rebuild the infrastructure, to pay decent amount of money to the workers, almost crucially to rebuild the officer and the seamen corps that has been ravaged by the revolution. And the crisis that Navy finds itself at the beginning of revolution deepens as the revolution unfolds.
And I suppose this crisis is only going to deepen as events begin to unfold, as the revolution unfolds.
Indeed. When the convention came to power in 1792, it tried to reestablish order in the Navy by sending representatives on mission to the ports. Most famous of these probably is Representative Jean Bon Saint-André, who actually turned out to be, unlike what we usually think of these political commissars, he actually turned out to be outstanding in this role, and he played an important role in bringing some sense of order to places like Brest, where the French Navy saw slow recovery. But the reconstruction of the French Navy is slow because, unlike Britain, which can afford putting all of its eggs in one naval basket, France is being threatened on all sides, and the primary national security challenge is on land. So the army, by the very reality of it, would receive preferential treatment over the Navy. Second problem is that because French have suffered such an exodus of the officer cadre, of the loss in the crews and supplies, it will take time to rebuild the capacity. Indeed, oftentimes, the French Navy, even with all that handicap, actually performed not bad during this period. We might forget that it was in 1794, in June, that the French Navy was able to carry out a naval operation recapturing Guadeloupe from the British.
Yeah, that's a good point. And one that hopefully we can make throughout this, that it's not quite as straightforward as some history books might suggest.
One thing that strikes me as a Francophile is that, woeful as the French Navy was, it was not totally eliminated from the sea by the British all-powerful Royal Navy, and that the French continued to achieve certain success. We just talked glorious 1st of June, but we will also discuss other successes that the French had achieved through this period.
Having looked at the strategic points underpinning the French situation, it's now time to look at French politics. And here we turn once again to Professor Marisa Linton of the University of Kingston, who returns to the podcast, having last been seen in episode 7. In the last quarter, Robespierre and co. were forced to shut out both the radical sans-culottes supporters, people like Hébert on the one hand, and then the indulgents like Danton on the other. So here's the aftermath amidst the Great Terror. But first, as Danton and Desmoulins end up being executed on April the 5th, it's quite right that Marisa begins by looking back at the events of those last 3 months.
The Committee of Public Safety has been facing, in the previous months, in the spring of that year, threats to its power, which it sees off, basically. Those threats were through the Hébertistes, the leaders or self-appointed leaders of the sans-culottes movement, and also Danton and his associates. And the Committee of Public Safety joins forces with the Committee of General Security to bring down Danton, Desmoulins, and the people associated with them. They're executed on the 5th of April. So that happens really quickly, that whole process. And the committee members of the two committees join together to bring that about, to arrest those men before they have, in fact, been officially denounced and before the convention has been able to decree their arrest. So they really preempt matters there. It's a very, very brutal and sudden thing when it happens, that the arrest of those deputies, and they rush in to put them on trial and then to kill them, basically. It's a political trial.
And when that's all done and dusted, when the dust has settled, what is the state of play after that's out of the way?
After the death of the Dantonists, it seems that the Committee of Public Safety is more powerful than before. It doesn't seem to have threats to its power within the convention, but also because people are very afraid then to go up against the committee. So it seems as though they're at the sort of the height of their security, yes. But there are many other things going on at the same time, which makes their position precarious. So if you look, kind of, it seems as though they're strong, but in fact, there are many, many things going on under the surface.
Well, let's unpick some of those things. What might you try to sort of pick out the problems that they're facing?
That the committee faces. Well, one of the problems is Robespierre, who, in my opinion, is going through a real personal crisis through the early of 1794.
What sort of crisis?
Well, where do you begin, really? He's a man who's managed to compromise many of his own beliefs, really, in the service of the revolution. I think by then, I think he personally found it very, very difficult that he was in going for Danton and Desmoulins in particular, who was his personal friend, that he found that very, very difficult. I mean, he did it, but I think he was losing his grip somewhat. Yes, I think so. He was also physically becomes unwell. It's a little bit later on, but he's had bouts of physical illness. But I think, I mean, they don't have a word for it in the late 18th century, but I think we would call it something like burnout.
Well, I'm not surprised. This has been so extreme, this whole process. But the strange thing about the first 3 months, as David Andrus was describing in the last episode, is that Robespierre's position was almost a moderate one, in the sense that, or at least he was trying to find a middle way through, and you had these two competing factions, you just had to shove them both out of the way. And it's almost like everyone's been got rid of, and his faction are the only bunch left.
He comes to agree that Danton Desmoulins should be arrested, only reluctantly. We know that because when Robespierre himself was denounced on the 9th of Thermidor by Bio Varenne, also on the committee, Bio Varenne said that the first time that he himself, Bio Varenne, had said that Danton should be arrested, Robespierre had leapt to his feet shouting, you want to arrest the best patriots. So there were people on the Committee of Public Safety more extreme than Robespierre. That was certainly the case. But when they go for the Dantonists, it's all about unity. It's all about the committee sticking together. And Robespierre certainly hesitated and was torn. But when he decided that he would fall in with that, he is absolutely central to it.
And at this stage, Robespierre is elected president of the convention.
He is, yeah. I mean, that's something that they take turns to do. They're elected. It's for a 2-week period. They will be president of the convention. He's president for that period when they have the Festival of the Supreme Being in early June.
Well, tell me about that, because what is the deal with the Festival of the Supreme Being? It sounds, I don't know, it could be a lot of fun, or it could just be a bit weird.
it was actually a great moment in many ways. There's been some research done on it recently to show it wasn't as kind of wacky as people might have thought. Certainly Robespierre was very much behind it, but his thinking what he wanted to do was to get past some of the brutal de-Christianization that some of the more extreme revolutionaries have been carrying out. And he was very aware that Catholics, and most people in France were still good Catholics, that many Catholics felt very alienated by the idea that the revolution was against the Catholic faith. So the idea of the supreme being, it's basically a deist concept from deist thinkers of the 18th century. It's an idea you can bring people together, you can rally them around something on which they can agree, which is that there is a God, a providence, not necessarily Catholic, not necessarily even Christian, but that there is a God and he is good and good people go to heaven after they die. So those basics. And it was supposed to be a big festival of celebration and joy and unity, but it doesn't quite work out like that.
Well, what form did the festival take and how was it received?
Okay. For the day, they took down the guillotine because...
It's so grim, isn't it?
Yeah, and also the procession. There was a huge procession from the convention of all the deputies. Robespierre was at the head as the president, and they actually filed through the Place la Révolution, what is now the Place la Concorde, which is where the guillotine was standing. So they took that down, not nice. And this massive procession had lots of popular participation. David, the artist, who was also a member of the Committee of General Security, orchestrated it. So the designs, the layout. And it was very much about the people celebrating their revolution, their God. They all ended up at the Champ de Mars, which is where the Eiffel Tower stands now, more or less. And they built a mountain for the deputies to stand on, literally engineered a mountain for them to go on. And they sung to the supreme being. And general benign aura swept over all. It was in many ways, it was very popular. They had a very big turnout. The idea of a supreme being wasn't so very strange to people in the 18th century as we might think now. So it may have been partly that. But also, I think people really wanted a day out. I mean, if you think how now, we're all desperate for a day out. People really wanted a day out. They wanted to have some fun and come together. And it was very, very well attended, in fact, at the time, and very popular. They also timed it to take place on Whit Sunday. So
right, yeah.
Catholics, it was a day they would have celebrated anyway. So big turnout. They also had other smaller festivals of the Supreme Being and other parts of France, and a lot of those went quite well. But afterwards, there was quite a lot of feeling that this would mean the end of terror.
Yes, and this was just a day off, in fact, and we've got the new law of suspects just round the corner.
Law of Prairial was passed.
Law of Prairial.
Yeah, that's it.
So what was the Law of Prairial, and how did that contribute to the terror?
It tightens up the procedures of the Revolutionary Tribunal in Paris. So it's harder to call defence witnesses. The only judgment should be death or acquittal, nothing else. And, I mean, it's a brutal law. It's something that Robespierre backs. It's presented by Couthon, his friend on the Committee of Public Safety. Robespierre backed it. And it's something that frightens people because they see themselves as having less chance, really, of escaping.
And was that borne out by the statistics, as it were?
Within Paris, yes. I mean, what is happening? The law of Prairial is part of a process of centralisation of terror. It's more suspects are being brought to Paris. Their cases already have been in part heard, and that's why the procedures are speeded up. So, in fact, fewer people are being executed by tribunals in other parts of France. So the incidence of terror there is going down. But in Paris itself, it goes up, it rockets.
Ah, well, let's lay the groundwork then for what might be coming in terms of Robespierre and his prospects. So where are we? April, May, June. So let's say by the end of June 1794, is there anything in the waters that would suggest that Robespierre didn't have a bright, long life, a long-lived future ahead of him?
The end of June, you said, yeah.
At that point,
he's not attending meetings of the Committee of Public Safety. The last few weeks of life, well, you may ask. He wasn't feeling well. But as I said before, I think that may be psychological as well as physical. He wasn't feeling well. But he also didn't like his fellow committee members and didn't trust them. So there was starting to be a huge breakdown within that committee and also between that committee and the other committee, the Committee of General Security. And Robespierre himself was much disliked and much feared by the other by some of the other members of those committees. ¶¶
Teresa Linton there, and she's talking there about the Great Terror during this period. Charles, how bad was it across France? There's a sense of the entire country now facing a much more effective, centralised and therefore much more sinister operation.
How bad it was depended on where you were. If you were in the Vendée, somewhere which had fiercely, well, risen in revolt, if you were in the Vendée, the terror was very, very nasty indeed, because the terrible executions and massacres that we talked about before continue into the spring and summer of 1794. If, however, you were in areas which on the whole had rallied to the revolution, the terror was something which was unlikely to touch you very much. Now, it should be remembered that the vast majority of people who die in France are not the aristocrats who we all think of, you know, they were ordinary people who were caught up in the counter-revolution in places like Lyon, Toulon and the Vendée. The political terror, if you like, the purge of Republican dissident groups, the purge of aristocrats and so forth, actually affects comparatively small number of people. I forget the exact total, but I mean, how many people were executed in Paris? 2,500? 2,700? Something like that. The purge that we all think of, the guillotine in Paris and so forth, was actually far, if you like, less savage than the one that we don't tend to think about, which is the repression in the provinces. But one way or another, terror really did matter. So a very, very important episode, and certainly a very frightening episode if you are a member of the political class and you're watching one group after another being taken out and dealt with.
Well, let's look at the revolution itself. And is it, Alex, just a case of there being no one left now? I mean, the number of trusted people, the circle seems to have grown to, I don't know, one. Is there something inevitable about the end game now approaching?
I think so, in the sense that I think Danton's trial was that message, a clear kind of warning that so long as the revolutionary government remained in power, it will not tolerate any challenge to its leadership. And if a person of Danton's magnitude, scale, and contribution could be simply dealt away like this, then what can we say about others? I need to emphasize a couple of things here in terms of just revolutionary processes. To strengthen its authority, the convention, right, in April abolished the ministries that would have been in charge of the government policies, and instead it consolidated authority under control of Committee of Public Safety. So that in itself would have been also a kind of a worrisome development, the increased dictatorial power that this committee held. Within the committee, we know that there were a lot of debates and disagreements, in fact, to such a degree that by late spring, Carnot, as he later describes, had to move its meetings to a secluded, isolated room so that people could not see, as he put it, the storms that agitated us. There is actually distrust between the committee members as well, which grows to such an extent that Robespierre and Saint-Just effectively are running a parallel government network, or essentially police kind of network, to the one that the committee and the convention themselves did. Furthermore, the extent to which all of this is unpopular among the common Frenchmen, in this case Parisians, was underscored when in May, I think May 26, if I'm not mistaken, a Frenchman, Henri Amiral, tried to assassinate Robespierre. He loitered around, waited for Robespierre to come. Amiral was a former servant, unemployed for many months, and who blamed his personal kind of misfortune on the leadership of the Committee of Public Safety. Now, he couldn't get to Robespierre, so he tried next best thing, which was Collot d'Herbois. Fortunately, Amiral missed, right? He shot twice and missed, but this was a clear indication of people willing to go to that extent.
Yeah, that sort of thing really shakes people up, doesn't it?
Indeed. In fact, it's not an isolated case. We know that at the same time, that same week, Stationer's daughter, Cécile Renaud, was detained after she tried unsuccessfully to get to Robespierre, and there were knives discovered in her blouse. The ordinary Parisians, four ordinary Parisians, terror was not necessarily delivering on the promises. There are still shortages of food, key necessities. In fact, a system of bread rationing, right? A bread rationing was widespread. And what made things worse was that by the summer, authorities began insisting everyone to have that carte de civisme, right? That the small piece of paper that proved your civic loyalty. And that carte de civisme had to be obtained from a local surveillance committee, which meant that you had to prove to some overworked official that your loyalty to the state. That was quite, I think, both humiliating and onerous and frustrating. The authorities used the law restrictions, for example, on wages to deter workers from demanding for higher pay. In fact, strikers were punished, severely punished, ostensibly for undermining the war effort, even though the workers simply were expressing the reality of their concerns.
Time then to travel to Flanders for a review of the fighting during this three-month period, and it's another welcome return to the podcast for Philip Ball of Helion Books, or is it Helion? Anyway, Philip's another PhD candidate and military historian of the period. Now, in season one, Philip talks rather a lot about Mac, the unfortunate Mac, and here he is once again, just as unfortunate, but this time dragging the Emperor Francis II along with him.
At the beginning of the year, they've brought back General Mac. Whoa! You know, this is sort of he's seen as like the sort of the golden boy of the Austrian High Command. Only most of the Austrian High Command don't actually like him. So,
It sounds like he needs his own theme song.
Return of the Mac. I know, right? Yes. This was a bit of a joke I had with Andrew Bamford. I did have a chapter in the book originally called "The Return of the Mac," but I thought that was pushing it a little bit, so we ditched that, and it's just "Return of Mac" now.
Aww.
But he's a very interesting character. Basically, he sort of ingratiated himself with the emperor and got himself in quite a high position for someone of rather low birth. He's a lot more go-getting than your average Austrian commander, and the British really like him. They like the fact that he's got some ideas and he wants to actually get out there and attack the French. He has a bit of a falling out in 1793 with Coburg, and he gets sacked, basically, and then he gets himself wounded, and so he goes back to Austria. And that's it, as far as he's concerned. War's over. I'll go back to doing nice, boring staff work. But the British are very keen to have him back and sort of agitate for his return. And he basically has a deal whereby he'll come back, but only under the Emperor's personal command. So the Emperor duly turns up to take command of the Allied forces, and Mac returns. Great fanfare. They whisk him off to London on a fast boat, and he discusses plans with Pitt and Dundas and Grenville and all the other cronies in London, and they go, "That's a splendid idea." And he comes up with what they call the plan of destruction.
So what is this? It sounds ominous, like something out of Star Wars. What is the plan of destruction?
Right, so basically what's happened, a large portion of the French forces have become basically surrounded by Allied forces, who up to this point have not been coordinating. So Mac, in his inimitable style, decides on a massively complicated convergence of these Allied forces. I think there's something like 9 columns involved. The British chief of staff says, well, if anybody looked it on a map, they'd say, that's not going to work, is it? It was quite obvious to anybody, the British thought, that this was never going to work, but they go along with it anyway. The Duke of York commands 2 of these columns, and he duly trogs off, and he takes his two main targets.
Whereabouts was this?
So,
where are we talking here?
We're in the border country between Belgium and France, Flanders, basically. We're right in the heart of Flanders, around Tournai, Tourcoing. So York goes ahead and he takes his objectives, and he's supposed to be meeting up with Clefay, who is coming down from the north.
This is another of the Austrian generals.
Who's an Austrian general whose name is spelt so many different ways, I've got no idea what the actual one is. I don't think even he knew. He's supposed to be coming. York doesn't like him. York has a very low opinion of Clefay. He thinks he's timid. And so he turns up his objective. There's no sign of anybody else. It can't hear any. It can't hear guns. So York writes to the emperor and says, I'm all on my own here. None of the other eight or so columns have turned up. Can I retreat? Can I go back, fall back on my lines to a defensive position further down the... And the emperor says, no, you must wait. Clefay is coming. You must wait. And Clefay is coming, believe it or not. He's had a bit of a trouble. He's reached, I can't remember which river it was, but he's reached a river and he can't cross it. His pontoons are right at the back of his column.
Oops.
So, and these are narrow roads. It's boggy countryside. Everything has to come up the roads. Anyway, he swings this bridge over during the night. And there's lots of sort of heroics. Austrian Jaeger swim the river and form a bridgehead on the other side. And he does get across. But he's, I think Van Damme is facing him. The infamous General Van Damme slows him up. So there's no sign of him from York's point of view. And York camps out in Tourcoing. And its immediate environs with his two columns overnight. What's happened to the other columns? It's a bit of a mystery. Where are they? They're supposed to be coming in from all directions. Basically, they've all had similar problems. Obviously, if every river crossing is going to be contested, it's going to slow you down. So they're miles away. They're nowhere near where they're supposed to be.
So what's the outcome of all of this then? Is Clefay going to show up? And because, you know, this is heading towards a real confrontation, I think, at Tourcoing.
It is indeed. So there's already been quite a bit of fighting, and the British, in the course of looting this town, set fire to it. So the French know exactly where they are. They can see them from miles around. Yes, Belgium, flat as a pancake. So you only have to shin up a church out. The British are over there. So the French, who are sort of largely rudderless at this point, because, what's his name? Begins with P.
Pichegru's
back in France, trying not to get executed. So he's delivering a report. I think he might have been ill as well. He's recovering. Anyway, he's not with the army. So it's under the nominal control of a guy called Souham. He gets all the others together and he says, the British are there. We know where the other Austrian columns are. They can't support him. We're going to attack them there. So what they do is they've taken the position where they were vulnerable and they've turned it round. First thing in the morning, they attack York.
Right, and because now it's turned around in the sense that he's now defending an exposed salient. That all of a sudden he's the one who is
right out in the middle. And York, being York, he hasn't put out sufficient pickets on the bridges. All these bridges, you know, everyone else has been having trouble getting across because the French are guarding them. He didn't bother guarding his. So the French come upon him in the night. So as the dawn is breaking, he finds that he's got French columns coming at him from every possible direction. They're all around him. He immediately pulls in the Austrian commander, actually into Tourcoing, who's also under attack. And they decide they've got a scarper and they fall back. But because the French have got in all round them, as they're retreating, they're constantly having their line of retreat cut off. So in the end, it turns into a bit of a mess.
Would you say Tourcoing is the decisive moment that is leading to the Austrians losing out here?
It should be.
You think so?
But when Pichegru turns up, he doesn't capitalise on any of this. The biggest problem with it is the wedge that it drives between the British and the Austrians. Because it emerges that some of the Austrian columns didn't move on purpose.
What? It's outrageous.
Yeah, it was implications in several accounts that they deliberately left the British out to dry.
No way.
For a number of reasons. Yeah, I told you it'd be interesting. one of the reasons, or the chief reason, is a guy called Thugut, who
this is the Austrian head of government.
He's with the army at this point.
Right.
And he came with the emperor, and he really doesn't want the emperor to be there. He doesn't want the emperor to fight for Flanders. He, as you've been saying throughout this series, is more interested in Poland.
Yes.
He doesn't, after this actually, but the emperor goes on a tour of Belgium and finds the Belgians to be singularly unsympathetic to his rule. And but Thugut has been pushing throughout for this part of the campaign to be ditched. Doesn't want this to happen. So there is an implication that he deliberately undermines this plan. And the Austrian staff are happy to go along with it because, A, they don't like Mac very much, so they're happy for him to fail. And B, they hate the Duke of York because he spends all his time getting drunk and saying how rubbish they are, basically, and casting aspersions on their abilities. And they've been fighting. Some of these people have been fighting since the Seven Years' War, and they don't want some sloshed up, port swilling British royal on his first campaign telling them that they don't know what they're doing. So he's put up quite a few backs. So they're more than happy to let this all fail. The emperor releases a very quick sort of like a press release, sort of, yes, we absolved the British of any wrongdoings. They did the best they possibly could do. And of course, he's left him out to dry as well, because the Duke of York did ask to retire. So there's a lot of ill feeling here. So the coalition is starting to fall apart. The crack's already there, but they're really widening now.
It's all going a bit wrong, basically.
It's going a bit wrong. Basically, like I say, they're on rocky ground, but they have recovered. They fight another battle at Tournai and beat the French. So they militarily recover. But because of this business with the emperor and Thugut, the emperor withdraws. He has his tour of Belgium. They all boo him or whatever, or don't show any. He slings his hook. He goes back to Vienna, and Mac goes with him. So, and with him goes the dynamism. The French, meanwhile, they've got the opposite. They've got idiots in charge who are making them do sort of really aggressive things that they're not in a position to do. They don't have the capability to do it. But there's a particularly unpleasant guy called Armand Saint-Just, who is a representant. He's been sent by the government to whip up Republican fervour and keep the army going. And he keeps throwing them across the Sambre. And they've done this five times. They go over, they get beaten, they come back. They go over, they get beaten, they come back. Slightly different story now. Jourdan has turned up.
Right.
And he's got reinforcements. They've restructured the army. He goes across the Sambre again and he besieges Charleroi. The emperor considers Charleroi to be very important to him. So Coburg rushes off immediately to relieve Charleroi. Only problem is the gap between the two sieges of Charleroi are so small that they haven't actually been able to resupply them from the first time. So the guys in Charleroi haven't got anything. Saint-Just turns up and he says, right, well, I know you haven't got anything. I think you should surrender. And the guy, the Austrian commander, sends him his terms. And Saint-Just says, what's this? Piece of paper? I don't want a piece of paper. I want Charleroi. And they surrender. And just as they're marching out, they hear the guns of Coburg's army turning up. The relief attempt has arrived. Too late. Obviously, Coburg doesn't know it's fallen, so he carries on anyway. And I don't know whether he's been inspired by Mac or what, but once again, we have nine columns advancing towards the French position. The French are in a sort of a roughly sort of an arc. And rather than try and outnumber them at any point, Coburg matches the arc and attacks them all along the front, even though he's outnumbered by quite a considerable amount. The French have got about 20,000 more men than he has.
Presumably he's hoping the professionalism of the Austrian soldiers will count.
He doesn't know how many the French have got. He's assuming it's about the same as last time, but they've been reinforced since then. And B, he is hoping that the quality of his troops is going to see him through and he's going to overcome the French. Same story again, you know. And it's another one of these great French victories that is so nearly not. had Coburg attacked first thing in the morning when he first arrived before the garrison had surrendered, he might well have done it. It was, you know, it was so close in terms of that amount of troops and the fact that obviously Hatry's division are besieging Charlois. He doesn't have any reserves at all. He commits everybody to his all fronts attack. And so initially it goes immensely well. The Prince of Orange does very well on the Allied right. A guy called Kwasdanovich blasts straight down the Brussels highway. They get across the river on the right. They get across the river. They actually get almost as far as Charlois, by which time they find it's already fallen and they're told to withdraw. And, you know, there's various sort of exciting vignettes within there that one of the French divisions, Marceau's division, legs it completely, entirely. The entire division run off the battlefield, leaving Marceau and his staff just like rabbits in the headlight. Oh, Where'd they go? They've all gone. And Soult, right. The famous, but later Marshal Soult comes with his regiment and just holds the position and tells Marceau, your men are making a disgrace of themselves. You've got to go and bring them back. And he just holds the position until Marceau's division return. And then that's it. The position is stabilised and the Austrians lose. But it's, again, it's not really much of a... It's not a crushing victory by any means.
Philip Ball there, showing both that the French rabble are actually becoming less of a rabble, but also that things could have gone very differently indeed. Charles, where would you place the emphasis then? Do you think the French are still a rabble at this stage? And you know, what's causing this? Or is it the Allied infighting that's critical? Or is it something else?
Yes, I mean, Allied operations were constantly, you know, fairly uncoordinated and so forth. But the French were getting somewhat better. And there were also a lot more French than there had been before. You know, conscription, thanks to terror, is working better than it had been. The French are rebuilding their armies. They've got the amalgame in place, which means that the volunteer battalions are now effectively part of the regular army and are brigaded alongside regular units. This is an army which is simply operating more effectively. I mean, it doesn't mean to say it's free from defects, it continues to suffer from them. But it's certainly an army which does its job well enough. And you can also see the same sort of advantages down on the southern front, the Battle of Boulou, which we mentioned earlier. What happens there is that the collapse of the revolt in Toulon and indeed Lyon allows large numbers of troops to be concentrated on the Pyrenean frontier, well in Roussillon at least, in the course of the winter. And the Spaniards have been suffering from disease. They had a few Portuguese reinforcements, a few Spanish reinforcements, but nothing to speak of. And they're simply hopelessly outnumbered. And when the French attack them at the Battle of Boulou at the beginning of April, they're simply rolled up and chased back across the Pyrenees. So whichever end of France we're looking at, I think that what we need to come back to is that conscription is actually working and delivering the goods. And that gives the French, you know, a considerable numerical advantage.
Yes, of course it does, because here it is one of the key theaters of war. The War of the First Coalition is indeed in this region. Compared to the operations in the south, in the Pyrenees, or even in the southeast, in the Alpine region, the operations in the north are clearly more important because the coalition diverted much greater resources to the Austrian and Prussian invasions from the north. But there was, I think, one of the problems that the coalition faces is not just having these hapless commanders like Mack or generals who are clearly not performing at their at their best. It's also the fact that some coalition members are distracted. You know, it's worthwhile mentioning here that partition of Poland is underway, and that Prussian, for example, interest is more aligned with affairs in Poland, where we are about to engage in a siege of Warsaw, where the Prussian king personally, right, is more vested about capturing Warsaw than he is about prosecuting any war against France. In fact, he contributes some 25,000 men and well over 150 cannons for the Prussian expedition to Poland against the Polish rebels, as they are referred to, instead of sending these reinforcements to the French theater of war. And that is to the French advantage. And as Charles pointed out, the French ability to take advantage of it and to put in place a system both of conscription, of centralization, of ruthlessness, which indeed punishes the failed generals quite to the full extent of severity, all that is now paying off in the late spring and summer of 94.
Great. So by the end of June 1794, the Austrians have given up on the Netherlands. The revolution is completing its logical process of turning virtually everyone in the country into an enemy of the revolution. And as we discussed in the last episode, these wars are increasingly broadening out to the Caribbean, to Poland and elsewhere. So plenty to discuss as we assess the situation at the end of this quarter, halfway through 1794. And Charles, as we look ahead, what are the prospects, would you say, for the next 3 months for the main sort of, you know, actors in this story of ours?
Well, I think you've gathered from what I've said already that the prospects for Robespierre and Saint-Just and company were not exactly very rosy. In terms of the war, well, thanks to the Battle of Fleurus, the French go on to reoccupy Belgium and set about preparations for annexing Belgium. But there's one point that I wanted to raise, and that's about the presence of Francis II of Austria at the front. Francis was, to be frank, no tyrant. He was a very decent, sensitive, rather timid man. He didn't like the idea of foreign policy adventures. He didn't like the idea of going to war, particularly. He was very conscious that the Habsburg Empire was financially challenged, to put it mildly. But Austria becomes involved in the war, and of course Austria plays its part. But he goes off to the front, and to be frank, he is absolutely horrified by what he sees. And the impression remains with him for the rest of his life. That's more strategic. Where it does matter is the later Austrian attitude to war. Over and over again, you see a Francis II, and by extension an Austria, who is most unwilling to go to war. So here you have a psychological experience which profoundly affects the Emperor Francis and does have a bearing on Austria's foreign policy right through the Napoleonic period. And it's one of the reasons why it's very, very foolish to speak in terms of an ancien regime which is absolutely bent on destroying France.
Well, Alex, how should we think about this theatre, the sort of Flanders Low Countries theatre, in the broader context? I mean, does it reduce its significance, would you say? You know, does it matter?
Yes. One of the, I think, interesting things to consider is the question of the extent of the French success. Because as we've seen, late spring has been very kind to the French arms. They've celebrated a series of victories. And now, if you are on a coalition side, right, you would have to consider, where will the French stop? If not, to what extent they continue this expansion? And what are they going to do once they arrive in these new territories? And that's something that will be an important undercurrent to all of our future discussions. this issue of how much is enough.
Great. So by the end of June 1794, the Austrians have given up on the Netherlands. The revolution is completing its logical process of turning virtually everyone in the country into an enemy of the revolution. And as we discussed in the last episode, these wars are increasingly broadening out to the Caribbean, to Poland and elsewhere. So plenty to discuss as we assess the situation at the end of this quarter, halfway through 1794. And Charles, as we look ahead, what are the prospects, would you say, for the next 3 months for the main sort of, you know, actors in this story of ours?
I suppose the obvious thing, since I mentioned Poland, is to go at the beginning, to go back to Poland at the end. Basically, what Kosciuszko and company were trying to do in Poland was to fight a total war. We've already talked about the proclamation of Polaniec, where Kosciuszko basically promises the emancipation of the serfs. Kosciuszko was influenced by what he saw in France. He believed in the possibility of a people's war. The trouble was that in Poland, the vast majority of the population had absolutely no interest in Polish nationalism, because Polish nationalism was very much a creed of the gentry. But the other thing was, it's all, let us say that you could raise mass armies. What are you going to arm them with? Poland doesn't have much of a manufacturing base. Essentially, what you see in Poland is but a faint reflection, in a sense, of what you have in France. And the Poles, they're going to go down fighting. They go down fighting extremely bravely, but they are going to go down.
I think the main question would be about the nature and direction of the revolution as such. We have been in this revolutionary process for 5 years already. And we've seen ups and downs. And in the last year and a half, the increased radicalization, increased violence, all of this would have been simply mind-numbing for the contemporaries. So the question you would have had in June of 1794, as Robespierre starts talking about the Great Terror, is about the very essence of what revolution means to you anymore. Are the promises of revolution that were made in 1789, 1790, are those promises honored? What about the new promises, the promises of the Jacobin dictatorship, Jacobin Constitution of 1793, which all of this wonderful democratic vision that it lays out only to be suspended and not fulfilled? Will they be delivered? Will the Constitution be in effect? Will the terror end?
Well, we're going to get a clue to some of the answers to those questions in the next episode. But for now, thank you to Charles and Alex. Thanks to Rachel Blackman, Marisa Linton and Philip Bull. Thanks to Ben Eckersley for all the music. At the end of this quarter, there are 7,657 days to go until Waterloo. And in episode 11, among my guests will be Marisa Linton again to describe the sticky end of one of this period's most important characters.
Most of them are his own people, which just goes to show in politics, the people you really have to look out for are not your enemies in front of you, or the ones wearing enemy uniforms, they're the people standing right behind you. And this is very much what happens.